Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary is Tack Theratrix.
I am Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Mumbai Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have
a prison!
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff to German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault?
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Rockfin or Rumble or listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks a million. We appreciate the support. Couldn't do it without you. If you want to connect with me, the brand new website is macroaggressions.io. You can find the link to it in the descriptions, not .com, .io. Also, big thanks to our sponsors. They make this show possible. Chemical Free Body has been with me now for about 4 years since right when the show started. And I take Greed 85 every single day. It's just powder. You mix it with water, drink it. It will help you feel better. If you have issues with weight, you might want to check it out. You're probably missing some nutrients that you need. And Green 85 provides all that stuff. You should just take a look. Just go to chemicalfreebody.com and read up about Green 85. You'll be blown away. It looks weird. It tastes pretty good. You couple that with what they call the detox bundle. That's a toxin detox, gut detox, ultra enzymes, and probiotics. You take that combo for 90 days, it will change you. Okay. I have done it now twice. The rest of it is just capsules. It's real easy. It's just drink a glass of green stuff in the morning, take a bunch of capsules, and tell me what you think. I've gone through it twice. I had to buy new shorts. I know what it'll do to me. Stands to reason it could do the same thing to you, but it's up to you. You'll get no hard sell from me. Just go to chemicalfreebody.com, read up about it. If you find something you like, use the discount code MACRO on your way out to save some money. And also, thanks to the folks at Legal Shield. I just used Legal Shield today. It's really easy. It'll get you access to an attorney in your area for $30 a month. It's $1 a day. I mean, it is very affordable. You get an app on your phone, which I have, and you just open up the app and tell them, you sort of push buttons and tell her, like, what do you need? I need this. I need that. Estate planning, corporation formation, whatever it is that you need, you just touch a couple buttons. It'll put you in touch with the attorney in your area, get you access to a high-powered attorney who has, on average, 22 years of experience dealing with things like that. If you get speeding tickets, parking tickets, whatever it is, documents that your work wants you to sign, send all of that stuff to your attorney. It's just the easiest thing in the world to do. Best place for you to go to get information about it is the website that they built specifically for this show, www.don'tgetpushedaround.com. That's the place to go. The link is down in the show notes, and you can find out more about Legal Shield there. It's available in Canada and the United States. They've been doing it for 50 years. They know what they're doing. So if you are so inclined, don'tgetpushedaround.com is the place to do that. Well, It's a big treat for me to have John Perkins back on the show. In order to maximize his time, I wanted to record this intro separately so that I could get the maximum amount of minutes with John. You know, I've been very vocal about this. There's been two real prominent people in my life that wrote books about things that I was unfamiliar with. And I read those books and it changed my life. One of them was David Icke. I had the pleasure of introducing him to the stage to do a virtual Q&A with him at a Narcopulco. That was a big deal. And John Perkins was the other one. He wrote a book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. I have the third edition right here. You should check it out. It opened me up to the concept of debt as a weapon. I always just thought of weapons as weapons and never really understood that you can get somebody or some country into a huge bind by taking control of their assets and using debt as a leveraging tool. And I read his book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, in March of 2007 while I was in Thailand. And I remember thinking that this changed my, you know, that I was never going to look at the world the same way. I didn't know I would wind up writing books or doing podcasts or any of the things that I'm doing. I just thought it was a great book to read while I was sitting out in the sun. And it opened me up to the possibility that my relationship with money was very different. The way I viewed the American empire was completely skewed. And John Perkins is a guy that was an economic hitman himself, had an epiphany, decided that he didn't want to live a life like that, changed his world, gave up the goods, wrote some amazing books. I don't even know how many copies Economic Hitman has sold. I think 10 million copies, something like that. I mean, it's amazing. So without further ado, the great John Perkins. Well, it's my great pleasure to have John Perkins back on the show. And the last time we spoke, you were in the process of getting ready to put out the third edition, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Now, I read this in 2007, and it changed my life. I had an idea about the American empire. I didn't really understand the concept of debt as a weapon. It was a new concept to me. Of course, now in retrospect, it's so obvious. I look back on all this, you know, but a lot's changed since your days as an economic hitman. I'm curious. We are, I don't know, 40, 50 years after the fact, and we have big problems with the American dollar. Can debt still be used as a weapon when the dollar is having such issues as it is right now?
Well, yeah. Let me just say that. So the book you read in 2007 was the second edition. So the third edition that you just held up just came out about a year ago, a little less than a year ago,
right,
which really focuses on China. And, you know, China's not using dollars, but it is doing exactly the same thing that I did in terms of putting countries into debt. So this whole debt situation is not dependent on the dollar, but it is dependent on having a very strong currency that's a global currency. And although the Chinese yen is not truly a global currency at this point, it's becoming that. And that's one of China's goals, is to replace the dollar with the yuan at some point. And China has to be careful about this, though, because China, in the United States, owes a lot of money to China.
Yeah.
And, you know, so China has to be careful about how it deals with the dollar, because it's owed a lot of dollars. It doesn't want to see the dollar go down too much.
Right. So we've got dollar problems. We see the BRICS countries putting together this gold-backed currency. Is that a possible threat? Is that something that could be used to entice other countries to get on board with their project? Or is that just simply going to be used for settling trade between the BRICS nations that are currently using it?
Yeah, I think the UN is really backed by the collateral of minerals that it owns, that it has rights to. In the collateral, for example, I just came from Ecuador, Guatemala, Panama, and Costa Rica. Just returned 2 weeks ago. I'm headed tomorrow to Mexico, where I'm on a television program with the former president of Ecuador, Rafael Correa, who was president for 10 years. So I'm really looking into these things very intensively. And Ecuador is a really good example of a country that's heavily collateralized its copper, cobalt, gold, and potentially lithium. And today, its debt is primarily to China, not to the United States anymore, to the Chinese banks like the BRICS banks and other Chinese institutions, instead of being to the World Bank or the IMF as it used to be. So these currencies are really backed primarily by the value of resources of the countries that owe debt, that have debt to either the United States or China or someplace else.
So, all right. So we've got debt as a weapon, and we've got minerals as collateral, right? And we've got a push towards the electric vehicle industry, and it seems that everybody has set their sights on South America for this. That tends to have a tremendous amount of natural resources, as you were well aware of. Is that going to be a net positive or a net negative for South America? Because you almost, you kind of want to have mineral resources, but maybe not too many. Because if you have too many, you put a big target on your country, and the vultures start circling. We saw what the United States has done trying to lock up lithium in places, and of course China's feeling the same way. They have the ability to process these rare earth minerals. And so they have a vested interest in getting a hold of this. Is this going to be a resource war? Is this the real conflict between the United States and China? Is it more of a war for resources in Latin America?
Well, Latin America and Africa, parts of Asia and the Middle East, And, the question you first asked was, whether these resources are a benefit or a disadvantage for these countries, and it should be a benefit. But the fact is, modern history, maybe not just modern history, history, including modern history, has often shown that it's a detriment. So here, if you look at Africa, it's the wealthiest continent in the world, resource-wise, and the poorest in terms of human prosperity. And Latin America is not too far behind. And so because of colonialism, because of imperialism, because of the way that these resources have been exploited by foreign countries, whether in the old days it was, the Spaniards and the Portuguese, and the French and the English and the Germans. Today it's primarily the United States and China. And it's not just, of course, the foreign countries. It's also corruption within the countries, so people who collaborate. So I mentioned I was just in Guatemala, and that's a great example of a country that's basically run by seven families. And these families all pretty much go back to the conquistador period, when members of their families back, great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents were generals in Cortez's army or Pizarro's in Latin America. These families were given tremendous amounts of land. And as a result, they've continued to control the politics in many of these countries. And they typically, not just in Guatemala, but throughout much of Latin America and Africa, the people in power have learned that the best way to survive and for them and their families to prosper is to collaborate with the foreign exploiters, the imperial powers. And that continues today. And so these resources in these countries that could be bringing great prosperity, bringing better health care, better education and other social services to all the people, tend to be funneled into making more and more riches for a few families and their friends and administrators.
You, You mentioned Guatemala. Let's stay in Central America here for a second. What do you make of what's going on in El Salvador recently? We've got Bukele talking about really reimagining his country, building a massive prison, locking up the gang members, pivoting towards Bitcoin, El Zante, Bitcoin Beach, all of this, mining Bitcoin using geothermal energy produced from volcanoes. I mean, he's really coming at this from a very different direction. Is that seen as a threat to the American empire, or is that somebody that they can work with?
Good question, Charlie. It depends on your point of view, really. It was interesting that when I was in Ecuador, 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, I can't remember. There was a tremendous violence. The newly elected president, Noboa, who was just in his mid-30s and had only been in office for less than 40 days, declared a state of emergency against the drug cartels. Now, Ecuador has always been considered one of the most peaceful countries in Latin America. It's wedged between Colombia and Peru, and yet it has not had the history of violence until now. And just very, very recently, the drug cartels have moved in there. And there's a number of factors that have driven that, including, ironically, the peace accords in Colombia with FARC, the terrorist organization. So they reached a peace accord, and FARC controlled a lot of the drugs throughout the world, and throughout, especially the Americas. When this peace accord was reached, FARC lost a lot of control, and so smaller and more other organizations came along and have been vying for control. And what we are now calling the gang wars of Latin America, of Ecuador. So in comes this new president, Noboa. And incidentally, he's from one of the most powerful families and richest families in Ecuador. But he says, I'm going to stop this. And he declares a curfew for 70 days. The next day, the gangs, the narco traffickers, basically declared war on Ecuador. They took over the streets. They started shooting people randomly. They took over the prisons. They already had control of the prisons, but they took, you know, guards prisoner. And they went into one of the largest TV stations and took 13 hostages there. I was there. I was in the jungle in the Amazon at the time, hearing about this on a radio that we had in there, being very concerned, I was supposed to fly to Guatemala in 3 days. I was leading it with a group of 15 people who I take every year, different groups. And they all had flights home. You know, we're going to be able to get up. We felt perfectly safe in the Amazon. We were safe. But if you hear some strange noises in the background, I got two cats that are going at it right now. They play and they fight. And anyway, so.
My two cats are locked out because they'll do the same thing. So don't worry about it.
Good. You know, mine are on this, what we call a castle, a stand. One's on a lower level and the other's on a higher. And they're going at it. I think they represent, what we're talking about here.
So
Noboa, the president, declares basically martial law, shoot to kill anybody who breaks the curfew, and gets everything under control. He went on CNN in the United States and speaks absolutely perfect English, better than I do. And very eloquent. And he was asked, so are you going to follow in the footsteps of Bukele in El Salvador? And Bukele basically is a dictator and has, people have put in prison. Yes, he's cut down crime a lot, and he's very popular for that reason. But basically, if you tell the police that your neighbor is dealing in drugs, they'll arrest your neighbor, and nobody ever may see him again. And so Noboa says, absolutely not. Ecuador is a democracy. I've declared a state of emergency for 70 days that I can do, but for everything else, I'm going to go back to Congress. We don't know whether that'll happen or not. Well, it remains to be seen what happens after 70 days. We're about halfway through that now. But so here we are dealing with a situation where all over the world, we're finding people who are dissatisfied with what's going on. So Putin in Russia becomes very popular. A Trump in the United States who seemed to take control. A Bukele in El Salvador. Milei in Argentina. We're seeing this over and over and over. We're also seeing somewhat of a backlash where a guy like Lula gets reelected in Brazil. So there's a real clash going on in the world right now. Does democracy work, or do people around the world want some sort of autocracy? And it's a very serious time that we're in as far as determining those things. You know, for me, I believe in democracy. So I hate to see the rise of this autocratic way of thinking, but I totally understand it because people are frustrated. You know, listen, you know, we're destroying the planet as we know it. And the United States government is dysfunctional. You know, can only arrive on a budget for every, you know, 3 or 4 months at a time. It's ridiculous. I'm going to Mexico tomorrow. I'm going to be on television with the former president of Ecuador. And I know one of the questions I'm going to get asked is, you know, if the United States is a democracy, why should any country in Latin America want to be a democracy? Because it obviously isn't working. You can't approve a budget. Every 3 or 4 months, you've got to go back in and fight over, and everything else. So that budget is just symbolic of so many things. So people are frustrated, and they don't see democracy as a method of solving these problems. I personally think it is a method. It's not working right now in the United States very well, but that's a different issue. It's not that the system itself is a failure. It's that the implementation of the system is a failure right now at this particular point in history.
Well, let's back up to a point in history where the American empire had a much different face on it. Back when you were operating as an economic hitman in Central and South America, what was the role of, from your vantage point, you were there while Operation Condor was happening. What was that like? Because I look back on that time and it feels like there were some very sinister forces at work there, the CIA, the Vatican. There was a lot of money being made and funneled. School of the Americas was an ongoing project that was turning out like a psychopath factory, it seemed like. From you had to have had a very different vantage point on this than anyone else did. What was your take on Operation Condor from what you could see back then?
Well, Charlie, it's, you know, we were at this time when World War II had ended. And at the time I was in the Peace Corps, at first in Latin America, the Vietnam War was going on. And then later, when I was an economic hitman, we'd moved through that. But there was still this tremendous fear, obsession with communism and Russia, the Soviet Union at that time. And I think that was used in a way to, so I write in this most recent book, the third edition, that there are really four pillars of economic hitman strategy. One is fear. So in this case, the fear of communism. And in all the images of Marxism and communism and Stalin and so on and so forth. So fear is one. The second one is debt. Put countries into debt and help them combat their fear by putting them into debt and, you know, helping them build up their militaries or whatever. And the next one is anxiety over scarcity. You countries are poor, you know, so if you come and buy into our system and take loans, take the debt from us, we'll bring you out of scarcity, out of your poverty. And the last one is divide and conquer. So, you know, pit different countries against each other. Pit the, you know, those who sided with the Soviet Union against us, even pitting countries in Central America against each other, as we did with Costa Rica and Nicaragua during the Iran-Contra deal. And it goes on and on. And so Operation Condor was implementing all of those. And it was based on this conviction, or at least alleged conviction, that the Soviet Union was planning on taking over Latin America. And Latin America is our backyard. You know, we draw back on the Monroe Doctrine and right. say, we have to defend this part of the world, to keep it in our sphere of influence. Right. Well, the fact, and Cuba was seen as Russia's, as the Soviet Union's vehicle in making this happen. Well, the fact of the matter is, the Soviet Union was never really strong in Latin America. That was a perception. There was no real truth to it. And I knew a lot of young people throughout Latin America that professed to be Marxists. But they didn't like the Soviet Union. They didn't want the Soviet Union on their land. They believed in the ideology of Marxism. Right. But they didn't believe, they did not want the Soviet form of government by any means. They did not like the Soviet Union. And, you know, the Soviet Union, interesting, and you can compare it to China today. So the Soviet Union had a very strong military. It had nuclear weapons, but it did not have a strong economy. And it did not have good technology. So the rest of the world didn't really see the Soviet Union as being an answer to anything. We saw it as an enemy. We feared it. We feared its nuclear weapons. We feared it taking over. In contrast to that, of course, today China has a very strong economy as well as a strong military. It has amazing technologies. It has a lot to offer other countries. It's brought a lot of, it's brought about 900 million people out of poverty. The Soviet Union never did anything like that. So there really wasn't the threat that we portrayed. But our politicians, people like Henry Kissinger and many others, you talked about this red tide of communism that was going to take over Latin America. And we instituted this Operation Condor, which basically backed right-wing fascist governments throughout Latin America and performed coups against ones that didn't go along with that. Or for, the first step was to have me, you know, people, me and my associates go in and try to get these countries through debt to come to our side. But if that didn't work, then we sent in who we called the jackals, who overthrow governments as they did with Pinochet in Chile and many others, Arbenz in Guatemala and so on and so forth. And if that, you know, if the coups didn't work, then there were assassinations, like two of my clients, Jaime Roldós of Ecuador and Omar Torrijos of Panama, things I write about. So, yeah, you had this period of this time of Operation Condor, which was really an attempt to convey the perception, and perceptions mold reality, to convey the perception that these countries were unstable, they were dangerous, they were going to turn against the United States. And we had to do everything we could to stop that.
You mentioned these powerful families that had control of countries such as Guatemala and Ecuador, places like that. Did they send the family members through School of the Americas as well? Was it important for them to get an education on how to deal with the general public?
Yes. Yeah, either family members or people that they hired. You know, their top guns. Who, you know, so it wasn't always the family members that became president. It might be somebody else, but they were under the control of the family members, supported financially in every other way. And they would have mercenaries who were sent to these schools. So it was both family members and others who worked for the families. And yeah, and I should mention, you know, going back to what we were talking about before, so part of Operation Condor was about controlling the resources, of course. Ultimately, that was the goal, control the resources. And American corporations were brought in to play part in that role, particularly in those days, our oil companies, but also the big agribusinesses that formed alliances with these families that owned tremendous amounts of land and therefore could grow bananas or papayas or whatever it was that they wanted to, the agribusinesses in the United States wanted.
So we've got a new player running an old playbook, right? We've got the Chinese now coming in. And this is one of the focuses of the new book, talking about China's economic hitman strategy. With it's obviously going on in Africa as well, but we'll stick with Latin America. Where is the problem with this? Is the problem that the quality of the Chinese infrastructure projects is low, or is it that somebody is muscling in on our turf, meaning this is what America has always done and the Chinese, you know, we should keep the Chinese out? How does Latin America view China? Do they view them as a quality partner, or do they view them as somebody that builds kind of half-assed projects that fall apart in 10 years?
Well, again, it depends on who you talk to, because from a politician standpoint, a head of state, like the man I'm meeting with in Mexico City, President Correa of Ecuador, 10 years was president. And during those 10 years, he really switched from accepting loans from the World Bank and U.S. organizations to going to China. And China then built these huge projects in Ecuador. And as you point out, as I write about in the book, much of their engineering was faulty. You know, they built a huge hydroelectric project on a fault line next to an active volcano.
That's the Coca-Cola Sinclair Dam. Is that the one?
That's right. And it's never functioned properly. In fact, it's generating generator house, which has 8 generators in it, is riddled with cracks currently. So bad engineering. Now, and I will say that I think most of the engineering the United States companies did in my day was good. They were good engineers. Yes, we were exploiting the countries, but we did do good engineering. And, you know, the Chinese will say, well, they're on a learning curve, getting better, which may or may not be true. But at the same time, they have provided an alternative to the American way. So one of the benefits of the Soviet Union during my day was that if a country, let's just say any Colombia, Ecuador, whatever the country is, if they felt too pressured by the United States and our debt conditions, they would at least make overtures to the Soviet Union. And usually that would get the United States to back off a little bit to offer better terms or whatever, and they would turn to the United States. But after the Cold War, there was no alternative. The United States was it. Monopoly, basically. And we had tremendous control. And now China comes in as a balancing force. So from that standpoint, you could say that it's a good balancing force. However, I would also say that imperialism, exploitation is always a bad thing, no matter how you look at it. And really, what needs, I hate the word need, because we can all say, we all know what needs to be done in the world. You know, we need to stop climate change. But the challenge now facing Central and South America, as well as Africa and many other parts of the world, is how do you develop your own local economies in a better way? And most of the free trade agreements like NAFTA and CAFTA in Central America, and including Mexico with NAFTA, are highly favorable to big U.S. corporations and very detrimental to small farmers and small businesses in these countries. That's a terrible mistake. What we want to do is turn, and if we want to stop the immigration problem, we need to make the economies of these countries fair. And, you know, give them the opportunity to prosper within their own countries, because many of our free trade agreements have absolutely destroyed the small farmer of Central America by opening the door to big U.S. agribusiness, which actually it costs more to produce a bushel of corn, let's say, here in the United States than it does in Guatemala. It costs a lot more here in the United States. But because of our subsidies, we can sell that corn, our big agribusinesses can sell that corn in Guatemala for a less price than what a Guatemalan farmer has to charge because of what it costs him, which is ridiculous. And therefore, the farmer goes out of business. All the businesses that are associated with the farmer, the one that sells him equipment or seeds or his bank, his insurance companies, the places where he goes to have a cup of coffee in the morning, they all collapse. And so people in these countries are left with the choice of, well, do I starve? Do I try to migrate to the United States? Or do I go out on the street and for $10 buy a small bag of fentanyl and sell it someplace for $150?
Yeah, I'd always heard of the very obvious component of the U.S. destabilizing Central America militarily and creating conflict and creating the justification for people to want to leave there and go somewhere else, notably the United States. But maybe the economic side to this is even more devious, because it's not physical bombs raining down, it's subsidies that most people don't understand or don't see that wind up economically gutting these countries. And what you're saying is that is actually the real justification for these mass migrant moves. And you almost can't blame the people. If you stay there on your farm, you're going to lose money. You can't compete with the American empire, who's put its out, you know, its invisible thumb on Adam Smith's scale of marketplaces, and has created some sort of very skewed pricing mechanism that is maybe even worse than us bombing the countries?
Well, it's different. It's highly effective from the standpoint of big corporations. They make a lot of money off this. You know, they get the subsidies in the United States, and then they sell their goods in Mexico or Guatemala or Honduras or El Salvador or wherever at a price that undercuts the local farmers. And so, yeah, you know, there's a lot of corruption in Latin America. That's part of the problem. But we have to ask ourselves, who causes the corruption? Corruption doesn't grow on trees. You know, it's like somebody's got to be doing it, and it's us to a large degree. I think we in the United States, we really need to understand that the immigration problem is caused by our policies. You can hear those cats now, probably.
I can hear them.
One of those policies are the free trade agreements, which benefit big corporations. But another one, which isn't necessarily a policy, but an outcome, is the demand for drugs in the United States. Mm-hmm. So all these drug cartels and these wars that are going on are not really about providing drugs to the people in these countries. There are people who take drugs in Latin America. But the real money and the real driving force behind narco trafficking is U.S. markets. And I think it's really important that we look at this. You know, a wall or any kind of law enforcement along the border is never going to stop incredibly desperate people. And what will stop them is to give them the opportunity to live within their own countries and make a decent living there without the threat of big drug cartels or gangs. And, you know, I speak Spanish. I go outside my door here and I can find Mexicans and Guatemalans who are working in everybody's gardens and in all the restaurants. And, you know, they're very hard workers. And I talk to them. They don't want to be here, most of them. They love their country. Their families are back there. They're sending all the money back there, but they can't survive back there. That's why they have to come here and send their money. But if we could create an opportunity in those countries for them to make a living there, we'd end the immigration problem. That's the way to end it. That's the only way to end it, ultimately.
Wouldn't it be ironic if China fixed our immigration problem for us because they invested in Latin America in a way that made it more sustainable for the natives in Latin America to stay, or in Central America also, to stay where they are, right? That they created, aren't they the number one investor in Latin America? I think your book put numbers anywhere from $250 billion to $315 billion of investments. Is that a fair analysis? Could China turn this around for Latin America by giving them an incentive to stay home?
That would be a great benefit to everybody, including the United States. We wouldn't see it that way. We'd see China is taking over, and ultimately, it might be a problem because we don't know where China will go if it becomes the world's number one superpower, which is fast approaching. Although it's had some recent setbacks, even since that book was written a year ago. You know, President Xi has made some big mistakes in the last year or two, So, you know, but it is a very interesting concept. You mentioned, wouldn't that be ironic? It would be ironic. It also might be a big benefit to everyone if they could do that, if they could really help the economies of Latin America. I frankly don't see them doing this. I see them following in the footsteps of the great empires throughout history and wanting to just channel the resources and bring them home to China. Maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong. You know, and there are different China's leader, like Deng, back in the day when he really, really introduced policies in China that brought people out of poverty, that increased the country's economic growth tremendously. He might do this. I don't see the current leadership in China moving in that direction, however, unfortunately.
What is the perception of the Chinese involvement in Latin America by the local Latin Americans? Do they feel that it is non-interference, or do they, I mean, because now they have something to compare it to. If they looked at what America has done over the years, that's definitely a hands-on policy in financially and maybe economically and with the hitmen and convincing people to vote a certain way in a UN resolution or privatize their lumber. They've seen what America's help has done. Do they have a different opinion of China at this point? Do they see them as a America part two, or do they see them as somebody that is a little bit more hands off?
Well, no, I don't think they see them as more. Well, maybe they do see them as more hands off because they are more hands off from a political standpoint. They do not try to dictate government policies. They don't pass judgment on whether a country has a dictator or a democracy. They don't try to control. And for us, we would support either. Like, you know, when Pinochet took over Chile, he took over from a democratically elected president whom we helped overthrow. So we supported a dictator. So, but we support policies and governments. They don't do that. They don't really take stands in government. So they're not interfering from that standpoint. However, when they come into a country, so here's another example. Ecuador, you mentioned that big hydroelectric plant, and they brought in an estimated 1,000 workers to build that plant. They could have been built by Ecuadorians, and Ecuadorians resented that. They resent the presence, and we're seeing, you know, it all over Central America, Costa Rica, everywhere. We see when the Chinese do something, they bring in their own people to do it rather than hiring locally. They also build these things in a way that all the replacement equipment has to come from China. So there's a lot of resentment around that. The reverse of that is that most everybody in Latin America really likes people from the United States. And they would like to live in the United States. They see the United States. They have this picture, right or wrong, of you know, paradise here, the land of opportunities. And they like Americans. The Chinese, when they go into these countries, don't tend to be particularly friendly for the most part. I mean, I hate to be, you know, cast a character, but they tend to be very isolated. They bring in all these workers. They keep them in their work camps out in the middle of the jungle or wherever they happen to have their projects. They keep them right there, all their people there. They don't let them out. Only the big bosses get to go out. And they can be very diplomatic. But there's a resentment of the people, I think, more than I don't think we don't have that with you don't have a resentment in Latin America of us as individuals. You have a resentment of our government policy. And they may actually prefer the Chinese government policies, but they don't particularly like the way that they're implemented in terms of lousy construction, lousy engineering, and bringing in all their workers and making sure that all the replacement equipment, all the maintenance is totally dependent on China.
So the Chinese workers don't necessarily integrate in a way. When you were with Maine, you guys were building projects in Ecuador, were you using local laborers? Was there a mix of that where you were boosting their economy by getting them involved? Or I know that a lot of that money was kind of staying in America. It was sort of going from the IMF and World Bank to your company, and then materials were I mean, I think a lot of it stayed in America as opposed to going to Ecuador. But was there some sort of network effect where the Ecuadorians in your era benefited from you being there as well, as opposed to maybe the way it is with the Chinese?
Yeah. The big money stayed in the United States. All the major engineering. If there were local engineering firms, we would try to involve them to some degree. But most of the labor was done by locals. And in fact, we made a big point when we arranged the loans, when we would tell government officials, hey, accept this loan from the World Bank to hire U.S. companies to build projects that are going to help primarily the rich people. More electricity, better roads, better highways. That was helping the ones people who own the industries primarily. Take these loans, pay pretty high interest, hire our companies to do this, and our companies in turn will hire, Mr. President, our company, I guarantee you that, I know you have a brother who's got a subcontracting pipe laying business, or we'll hire him. And you get the implication that we'll pay him $2 million for a job that's only worth $1 million. So this money did go back, and often in the forms of legal corruption like that, what I just mentioned. you know, overpaying for things, which is not illegal. I made a mistake. I could have negotiated better. I don't speak very good language, you know. I didn't negotiate very well. But that sort of thing went on. So, yeah, we were greasing the palms of a lot of people, not just under the table, but hiring a lot of workers. So, yes, and there was an appreciation for that. And buying local, you know, like local food, we'd encourage that. We'd buy a lot of Coca-Cola from the local franchise, Coca-Cola, who was the president's sister, who owned the franchise, you know. And we'd rent John Deere equipment from the local John Deere franchise owner, who was a wealthy friend of the president, you know, this sort of thing.
Gotcha.
That went on. But it did help the economies of those countries to a certain degree. And some of it did trickle down to some of the workers, at least and the perception was always there that this was helping some of those people.
Has America turned its back on Latin America? I mean, because it seems like there's a real pivot to worrying about Russia and worrying about Ukraine and Taiwan and the Middle East and all of this. And you mentioned the Monroe Doctrine. I mean, this is our backyard, as they said, mm-hmm. and this should be our priority. It feels as though we've sort of taken our eyes off of Latin America. Is that and maybe even created an opportunity for somebody like China to step in? Is that do you see it that way?
Absolutely. And I write extensively about that in the third edition of the trilogy, the Economic Hitman trilogy, that, you know, the biggest gift in a way that we gave to China was our tremendous focus on Iraq, Afghanistan, the Middle East, and basically, we zeroed in and put most of our resources there. Our investment and our relationships in Latin America, Africa, and Asia totally declined during that period. And China, on the other hand, hasn't gotten involved in the Middle East. It's very careful to stay out. And it jumped into the vacuum that was created in Africa and Latin America, particularly by us ignoring those parts of the world pretty much. And I think to a certain degree that's been recognized a little bit by the Biden administration. There's been sort of an attempt there, but now, of course, we've got Ukraine and we've got Gaza, the whole Israeli-Gaza thing, the Russia-Ukraine thing that has just taken a tremendous amount of our resources and our energy. And, you know, people just don't talk about Latin America except the border. You know, let's stop those people from coming across the border. Not let's create conditions that'll keep them in their countries, so to encourage them to stay in their countries. Let's just stop them. Well, you know, it doesn't work. It just plain doesn't work. It hasn't worked. We've tried it for years. It hasn't worked. It's not going to work because people are desperate. And when they're desperate, they'll basically do anything.
So I wonder about this. We've talked about the debt traps that the IMF and World Bank are really good at laying, and they come with some conditions, and probably not the greatest interest rates or terms. Is there something happening in Latin America where the countries have made a decision that they like the Chinese terms better than the IMF terms? Is there a way to settle those old debts, if they even still exist, with the IMF and essentially refinance with China as a backer, as opposed to somebody as predatory as the IMF?
Yeah, and some of them are doing it. You know, some of them are not. You know, it's, you know, there's such divergence of opinion and policies throughout Latin America. So Colombia looks at things very, very differently from, for example, Nicaragua or Honduras or Guatemala. And so there's a classic clash going on between these two superpowers, China and the United States. And in some areas where we've devoted more resources, such as Colombia, where we put in more resources, where we've moved our military base. Ecuador kicked our military base out under the president, a meeting with this weekend. Korea,
Right.
But the, and the United States moved it to Colombia, and has really focused on, you know, improving relations with Colombia and kind of just letting Ecuador go. And China's moved into Ecuador. And so this is give and take across the continent. It remains to be seen where all this ultimately is going to go. And again, I think that, you know, while the United States has made huge mistakes in terms of focusing so much on the Middle East and some pretty bad policies in Latin America, today China is doing some things to screw up and open the door wider for the United States if we take advantage of it. The engineering projects we mentioned, the impression that China is an autocratic and dangerous dictatorship, that Xi is a problem, that he's bearing down on the Muslim populations there, that he's a threat to Taiwan. These sorts of things are a concern to other parts of the world. But there is another aspect that helps China, and that, as I mentioned, the four pillars, the one of divide and conquer. Well, China has turned that around. So they created what, you know, they call the New Silk Road, or and the New Silk Road is an attempt to bring the world together using China's technologies and engineering to build ports in Latin America that will connect Latin American countries with African countries. So when we went in and gave aid to a country like, let's say Panama, or let's say Colombia, to build infrastructure, it was usually used for internal in the country. Well, airports would have been one of them to bring in people from outside, but roads and hydroelectric plants and so on and so forth. And we said then we want bilateral relationships with Colombia, between the United States and Colombia. We want to enhance that. Well, China's saying, yeah, we want to do that, but we also want to help Colombia become closer to Argentina through shipping channels, and to Kenya, to all of Africa. So this Belt and Road Initiative, the New Silk Road, is a reversal of the divide and conquer. At least it's perceived as that. That we want to bring, China's saying, we want to bring the world together closer. And of course, basically, though, all those lanes ultimately lead to China, to bringing the resources into China.
Right. Have they also brought a dangerous philosophy of surveillance, though? Because I've heard that they're exporting this surveillance tech to Ecuador. Right. As a test market for some of this dystopian social credit component that we're already seeing in places like Shenzhen, that you see 300 million facial recognition cameras. That doesn't make me feel all warm and fuzzy. Is that kind of a part of this deal? You want the New Silk Road? By the way, you're going to get some of this technology as well?
Yeah, that is part of the deal. And it's a mixed blessing. So right now, if you're an Ecuadorian, you might be happy for those surveillance cameras because they have helped, and also El Salvador, because they have helped cut back terrible amounts of crime. They have helped apprehend some of the narco traffickers and the gangs. So these things, you know, again, these things are seen as a mixed blessing. Yeah, I mean, we don't really want to be watched. But on the other hand, if being watched is going to make life safer for me and my children, maybe it's okay. And because I'm not doing anything wrong, it's being used against people who are doing wrong things. You hear those cats? I had to close the door, but I think we're coming to a close anyway, so we'll deal with it. I think it's kind of
cat-friendly around here. It's fine.
Yeah, you know, and they never hurt each other, which is really interesting. It's like it's a game, but it sometimes turns a little.
It's a metaphor, John, for what we've been talking about too, right? They're playing a role. They talk a big game, but in reality, they're working in cooperation with one another to convince you to give them more food.
Yeah, and usually one of them's outdoors, and one of them's an indoor cat, one of them's an outdoor cat. But because soon after this interview, I'm leaving to go over to the airport to head off to Mexico. They're both in now, and they're going to be in for the next 4 days. But they'll be separated most of that time when we have people feeding them. Anyway, yeah, it's a metaphor.
Well, let's talk about this. Let's talk about this new character that we've got. We'll wrap up with this. What do you make of Javier Milei in Argentina? You know, he comes out and he sounds like a libertarian's fantasy. He's saying all the right things. He's got the chainsaw and he hates the state. And he looks like a coked up Dudley Moore and Donald Trump mixed together. And it's really kind of tough to put your finger on exactly what this guy is all about. But you've spent quite a bit of time in Argentina. You know that this is a country that has spent the last, I don't know, half a century dealing with currency issues. What do you make of this guy?
He talks a good story. But so far, he hasn't been effective at all. He hasn't been in office for very long, so that's probably, we can't blame him for that exactly. I think we really have to wait and see what's going to happen. I am not one who thinks that the answer to Latin America is to privatize everything. I think privatization in general has been a big problem in Latin America. That, when you have companies like Bechtel go in and take over the water system of Cochabamba, Bolivia, it's catastrophic. And it was catastrophic. And one of the reasons Evo Morales became president is because he stood up against Bechtel and solved that problem. And you see this over and over and over again, the privatized utility companies, the privatized mines, the privatized big businesses have not been a good thing for Latin America in general. There have been exceptions. And so he's in favor of more and more privatization. Privatization has always been one of the conditionalities that the IMF has used, that when they go in and renegotiate a loan with a country that can't pay its debts that it owes to the World Bank, the IMF becomes the organization to go in and renegotiate. You know, one of the things they demand, usually, often at least, is privatization. Privatize your electric utility company. Sell it to U.S. investors. Right. And that is a policy that just hasn't worked well. It goes back to the days of Milton Friedman, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1976 and was a huge proponent of privatization. But it hasn't worked well. And so I suspect it won't work in Argentina. But that remains to be seen. Nothing seems to work in Argentina, and it's tragic. I remember as a young man, my dad was a Spanish teacher in a boys' boarding school in New Hampshire, and we had students from Argentina, and Argentina was, you know, really seen as kind of an amazing place back in those days, and it's been in decline pretty much ever since.
Well, it's a damn shame. I'm curious, what are you doing from here on out? You've got the third edition of the book is done. Are you still running trips to South America?
Yeah, I just came back from leading a group into the Amazon of Ecuador and then to the Mayan people of Guatemala. And then I was teaching for a couple of weeks in Costa Rica. So, yeah, and I hit the Mexico tomorrow. I'm heading out today, but I don't get there till tomorrow. And I've just written a novel, which could first, you know, I love writing, Charlie, just love writing. And I've written novels before, but never wanted to publish them. This one I'm going to publish, and it deals with many of these same subjects, and it takes place in the Mayan ruins of Tikal, which is my sacred site of Tikal, which has been fun. So, you know, my goal now for however many years I've got left is to do whatever I can to convince the world that we need a life economy to transform this degenerative death economy that's destroying the world as we know it into a life economy. And that's an economic system that pays them well. I'm not talking about living in caves. I'm talking about paying people to figure out ways to mine all the plastics that's in the oceans and recycle it, to, you know, fill in old mine pits and reuse the land over them productively, and come up with new technologies. You know, with wind and solar, we're on that track, we're on that path. But the tech, you know, wind and solar, I'm hoping that within the next 5 years, we'll look back on the wind and solar we have today and say, that was archaic. You know, we'll come on. I mean, it's good. I'm not criticizing it. But let's just keep advancing in these areas. Let's really understand how we can turn air into electricity. You know, there's just tremendous opportunities for a life economy, an economic system that rather than being based on maximizing short-term profits, regardless of the social and environmental costs, focuses on maximizing long-term benefits for all life on this planet. Human life, cat life, plant life, all life, you know? And that's where I want to put my whatever energy I've got left in my life is to, you know, it just takes a change of perception. Yep. A change of the goal, not maximizing short-term profits and materialistic consumption, instead maximizing benefits for future generations, for this generation and future generations.
You might need to take Congress down for some ayahuasca sessions, get them thinking about the world. Get them thinking about the world in a different way, man. I'll tell you.
It's so sad what's happening. And there's another concept that comes out of Latin America right now. And everywhere I go, people say, what the hell is wrong with the United States? And if you're a democracy, we don't want it. You know, it's kind of like they used to say about the Soviet Union. Like, Marxism is really an interesting ideology. But we don't want the kind of government that the Soviet Union has. Now they're saying, you know, democracy is a really interesting ideology, but we don't want the kind of government the United States has. It's dysfunctional.
Well, I would have to agree with them as well. I'm not a big fan of the current form of government that we have. And like you said, if we were able to have a paradigm shift in consciousness where we viewed the rewards differently, that system, and that we change to what you call a life economy, there's more than enough money to go around. You can still buy the Lamborghinis if you want. You just you'll feel better doing it because you know that the products or services that you make are contributing to making the world a better place as opposed to putting more plastics in the bottom of the ocean, which is something I think we can all agree needs to end. John, where's the best place for people to find you and to support your amazing work? Changed my life, by the way.
Thanks, Charlie. JohnPerkins.org. And it's all the information's right there, johnperkins.org. I'm an organism. I'm an orgasm. I'm not a com. And Charlie, come on one of the trips with me. Right now, actually, you know, I've not set dates yet for the trips, but those dates will go up soon on my website. And people can subscribe to my newsletter by just putting their email in the little box. And the newsletter only comes out once a month. We don't overwhelm you, maybe a little less than once a month. And all the information when it becomes available about the trips will be there. The trips are very affordable and extremely fun and extremely life-changing, frankly.
I would definitely want to do that. That would be a highlight to my life, to go on one of those trips and be able to see the things that you've seen. That's John Perkins, everybody. His books are transformational. Pick up Confessions of an Economic Hitman, 3rd edition, if you want to understand the way the world really works. And if you like this episode, take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. If you want to connect with me, the website is macroaggressions.io. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you again soon.